a better way. And we are live. Welcome, folks, to episode 3574 of the Survival Podcast. And it is Tuesday, October the 22nd, 2024. And today we are going to have a Just Jack Show. We're going to talk about something I really love, systems thinking. And what I want to kind of do as an intro is explain to you how I found out I was a systems thinker, not how I became one. Then we'll do our housekeeping, and then we'll go into 10 bullet points that explain systems thinking at a deeper level. I want that part to be almost a little collegiate in format. So we're gonna go deep into actual systems thinking. If I wanted to do this as like a paid class, like I do the paid classes for home food systems, it would probably have 40 points. So I just took 10 that I thought were the most important that would help you get your head around this and help you become more of a systems thinker and find out that maybe you already are. Because I found realizing what systems thinking was like when I first heard what libertarianism was. Oh, that's what I am. And in the religious world, when I found out what a deist was, I'm like, oh, that's what I am. And when I found out what systems thinking really was, I'm like, oh, that's why I piss everybody off. When I'm like, but what if this and what if that? And why don't we do this to make sure that that doesn't happen? Because people don't really like that in a lot of situations. That was something I had a hard time learning as a young man when I had no right to be questioning anything, but yet I couldn't help myself. So to me, like, I was always doing this. If I think back to when I was a kid fishing, be a good way to explain this is, you know, you'd be out fishing and you're fishing in a creek and all of a sudden there's some sort of hatch on mayflies or something and the fish are hitting the surface and they're hitting, you know, these flies that are hatching. And there's no way in the world, if you don't have fly gear, you're going to use like a fake fly or come up with one since you don't even have one. And you would need a fly rod or a fly bubble or something to be able to cast that little tiny thing. But you don't really have a way around this, and you're out there fishing with worms or something and or spinners or whatever, and they're just not having it. They're dialed in on, we're eating on the surface. And then, but over behind you, just outside the trees that are around the creek, there's grass and there's grasshoppers everywhere. This is true stories, happened many times when I was a kid, versions of it anyway. And so you're like, well, I get the grasshopper. The problem is the grasshopper, you got to be able to cast it out to where the fish are rising and not get too close to scare the fish. So you're watching these fish rise. You go catch the grasshopper, put the grasshopper on the hook with no weight. You ain't got enough weight to get the grasshopper where he needs to go. You ain't got no float, so you go get a broken piece of twig to act as a weight and a float. Take a knife and cut an edge in both, a groove in both ends of it and pull the line into it. If it falls off, you don't care. You just make another one. And now you can use that to get out by where the fish are. You kind of use it as a float and float that bait, and all of a sudden you're catching fish. Is that systems thinking? More accurately, what it is troubleshooting, which is a component of becoming a systems thinker. And so I was doing this my whole life, and I had no idea that there was a name for it. I just thought it was called not being a dumbass. I thought it was called being able to catch fish when your friends couldn't catch fish. But I realized over time that in anything that was important to me, that I would take this kind of approach, analysis, solution. Well, then when I was 17 years old, to get the hell out of that little podunk town I was in, I joined the United States Army. And they said, well, you can do it. It's about any job you want to do. And well, I wanted to know is what are the jobs I can do that mean I only have to enlist for like 3 or 4 years. I want to hear this shit about 6 or 8 year enlistments because I'm not sure that this is right for me. And one of the things they threw in front of me was, well, you can be a mechanic. And I'm like, well, I actually like working on vehicles. They said, you can be a heavy wheel mechanic. And if you do stay in, you'll get promoted really fast because nobody wants to do the job because big vehicles are hard to work on. I'm like, I like working on big vehicles. What I don't like working on are little ass vehicles where you got to be a rhesus monkey to get your fingers up in there. So, yeah, I'll do that. And they said, we'll also let you jump out of airplanes if you. That's okay. I'm in. So made that mistake and signed my name on that contract and gave up those years of my life. But I got some good out of it. And one of the things I got was troubleshooting is a terminology and understanding what it was. And so you're looking at this vehicle, especially when you're still in training, right? And you're like, well, there's this problem with the vehicle that they've caused to happen. And I know what's wrong, but maybe you don't. Here's your technical manual. This is the description of your problem. Here's how you look it up. And it walks you through starting at one end of the system to the other. And sometimes you'd find in your arrogance that you were wrong. It wasn't the problem. And then you got in the real world and you often found that as well. And the longer you actually followed the process, the more you could not need the process, because the more you were actually accurate in determining what was wrong as soon as somebody brought the vehicle to you. This vehicle needs a new clutch, right? You know, I don't need to troubleshoot it. I can tell, right? And so what I got out of that mostly, though, was this concept of troubleshooting as a process. And then realizing that it wasn't just for the things that I thought were cool or really wanted to do. It was anything that needed doing could be analyzed from one end to the other in a holistic manner. And then you could actually improve the process or realize the process had already been optimized or find the flaw, the single breakdown in the process without looking for it. You had to actually look at the whole process to find the flaw in the process rather than looking at each component individually. And so that became ingrained in me. And as I head into, you know, my professional career after the military and started getting jobs and basically had low-level jobs to begin with, and I would do this instinctually and just piss off my managers. And I would piss off the people I worked for because they were middle management and they weren't like me and they didn't really care about improving the process. And all they wanted was their people to do what they were told, and they wanted to do what they were told to do. And then that way they wouldn't get fired. Eventually they would get promoted. And they just did it on a time basis. They figured it's going to take me 3 years of dealing with these assholes like Jack here, and then I'll have to deal with assholes like me. And that's it. They were just basically doing the minimum to do their job in a way that didn't get you fired or in trouble. And that meant not taking any risks. Eventually, you know, I clawed my way up into those positions where I actually had decision-making capacity, and I started using these processes, and then my career took off. As soon as I got to a point where I actually had the ability to say, no, we're not doing this way today. We're going to do these things, and we're going to try that out, including splitting a crew and going, maybe I'm wrong, you know. And then as I moved into sales and I started doing this process with sales teams and marketing teams, then it really took off for me. But I still didn't know to call it systems thinking. I had no idea that's what I was doing. It wasn't until after I started this podcast that I found permaculture in videos by Jeff Lawton and Bill Mollison. And I was like, oh, this is cool shit. I got to learn more about this design science stuff, right? And one of the two, you know, I'm sure they both said it many times, but one of the two in a lecture, and I can't even tell you which one it was. It's so long ago now, you know, like 15, 16 years, said something about you have to think about the overall systems mechanics. You have to think at a systems level when you design a permaculture design. And I went, systems thinking, Google systems thinking, a discipline, blah, blah, blah. That's it. That's what I am. I'm a systems thinker. And so that means I was in my late 30s, having lived all my life thinking this way without really fundamentally understanding at this deeper level I want to talk about today, nor knowing what it was. It's just the natural thing that I did because it seemed like the way to get things done. And over time, you get better and better and better at it. But once you know what it is, then you can really dig into it and you can system analyze literally anything. So that's what we're going to talk about today. Before we do, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. Sponsor of the day number one today is USABerkeyFilters.com. That is Jeff, the Berkey Guy Gleason. If you get on over there, you can get great deals on Berkey systems and equipment and other items for your prepping needs. Jeff is a really great guy. He's been supporting this show one way or another since 2010. That's 14 years in the podcasting world. That's a big deal. You should definitely check him out. Again, USABerkeyFilters.com. If you want to just buy the filters right now, there is still problems over this lawsuit bullshit from the federal government. It's not completely rectified yet. They are taking some other avenues to correct it. And there's actually a waiting list on new filters that will soon be made available. But if you want to buy complete systems, you can do that right now and get the filters with them. Next up today is John Pugliano with the Wealth Studying Podcast. You tune into that, you can learn to grow your wealth the way we grow a garden. Long-term planned wealth development that gets stronger and better over time. John is an awesome investment manager. You know, I really don't like most people that call themselves, you know, financial advisors. And the reason I don't like them is I actually made a term for them, financial liars, because they're basically people that generally have no money, but they have good relationship and sales, you know, aptitude, if not skills. And they answer an ad, you know, and they go get training from American Express or Edward Jones or something. And then they just go out and relationship sell and have a mothership that produces the graph thing and they stick it in front of you and tell you everything will be great. Yeah, I'm not about that. I am about people that actually understand money and understand investment and manage investments for a living and make themselves millionaires before they do it for anybody else. That's John Pugliano, so check him out. He's also a prepper, ham radio operator, gardener, all the stuff that we talk about, and he always has been. I've known John since 2010 when I first met him at a prepper conference in Salt Lake City, Utah. Anyway, with that, let's kind of dig into this now. Oh, you know what? Let's go ahead and do that right now then. Gray Mouse says those Anchor power banks are on sale again. Let me pull this up then. We'll do the item of the day at the beginning instead of the end of the day since Gray Mouse brought it up. And if you don't believe me on the audio, come check the video out right at the where we at now. 11 minutes and 45 seconds, so you could see Gray Mouse on the thing. Yeah, Anchor power banks are on sale. About 80% of what Anchor makes is on sale today. And so what I've done for item of the day, instead of an item, is I just have a link to all the deals from Anchor. They're my favorite value electronics brand on the market, and they have everything on sale. And even a lot of things that aren't on sale, if you actually look at the product description, I don't know why people do it this way, but they have like a coupon. So like one is a set of earphones or a speaker that usually sells for $40 and it's on sale for 25% off. So it's $30. But instead of saying that, they have a $10 coupon. So check it out. If you guys want to help us out, you can always do your online shopping starting at tspaz.com. But yeah, Anchor has some bad ass deals today. Some stuff's marked down 15, 20 points, but some of the stuff's marked down 60%. And again, Anchor is a company that this is how I describe Anchor. There's a 99% chance you will not have a problem with anything you order from Anchor. But there is a 100% chance that if you do, they'll fix it and make it right. All right, with that, let's get into this. So let's start off with systems thinking. I kind of gave you this, the redneck duck farmer, kid from the coal region explanation of systems thinking in the intro. Let's talk about this more as a fundamental discipline, more at an academic level. So what is systems thinking? Systems thinking is how different parts work together to create a bigger picture of the system as a whole. So instead of analyzing this thing, if we were to put it out in a yard, we'd say, well, let's analyze the chicken. And there's value in analyzing the chicken, but it should be in the context of what role does the chicken play in the totality of the homestead, negative and positive. These would include things like intrinsic characteristics, like chickens like to scratch and dig holes in my garden right now. So I have to decide whether the chicken's more valuable as a chicken than the damage they're doing to my primary garden right now because they're becoming a real pain in my ass and corrective action has not worked. But if I only analyze the chicken, then I only say chicken scratch bad. Well, then nobody would ever have chickens or all the chickens would be in cages or tractors. Yeah. And even if you had the chicken in tractors, well, where's the tractor go? Where does it go next? Where was it the day before? Where will it be next week? If we actually understand the whole system, we would be able to answer questions like that. So systems thinking itself is simply looking at the totality. But as we move forward with this understanding, then we need to bring in a big fancy sounding word, but it's about the only word that really works here, and that is it is holistic versus reductionist thinking. holistic versus reductionist. So reductionist thinking is how most modern scientific studies are conducted, and it allows them to be flawed either due to this the methodology simply not working at all, or due to intent. So I do think a lot of the modern studies are intentionally flawed using reductionist thinking under the mask of science. In other words, we need to isolate this one thing, so we need to test it independent of everything else. Well, you do need to isolate the one thing, but you need to isolate it in common with other things. In other words, this has all of these things and this has all of these things and not this, right? Rather than this one has it and this one doesn't, but all other components are not exactly the same. Because there is a point to isolate and go down to individual components if you're testing to see if they're effective. But you all, if you're a systems thinker, you want to, well, what makes them effective, right? So that becomes additive. That becomes additive. So if we look at this from scientific studies and some of that I really, you know, get a lot out of, which is biochar. The first studies done with biochar were reductionist. I know, we want to know if biochar makes plants grow. Hold on, nobody fucking said that. No, we're going to do it anyway because that's what everybody thinks. But wait a minute. No, we're going to go do this way. So you take these two fields that are completely denuded to shit, that won't grow anything, and you throw fertilizer on one and seed, and you throw biochar and seed on the other, and the biochar one does worse and they both do bad, you say biochar doesn't work. That's reductionist. That's reductionist. If you were doing holistic, which means you want to incorporate as much as possible into the system that makes sense, not to the point of actually damaging the functioning of the system, you would start asking, like, well, why would charcoal help plants grow better? It has no nutritive value, but it does retain moisture. That's important. But what else does it do? It provides a place for, like, microorganisms to live, and microorganisms have to play a key role in the health of plants. They actually need, the plants need the microorganisms, and the microorganisms need the plants. And that actually plays an overall role in the soil health. So what you would do in a holistic trial is you would use living soil that's already healthy, and you would add biochar to it, and you would test the result across time. That's a holistic view. That's an additive view. How many things touch this system? Another way to look at it, think of a game that many of us, if you're Gen Xers and older boomers, play with your kids, a game called Mousetrap. Mousetrap is kind of a systems thinking game as a whole, because you don't have a thing that the, you know, when the mouse lands on it, he's trapped. You have a system. Little teeter-totter, little man jumps, and the marble rolls, and the thing comes down. And if anything goes wrong in that contraption and the thing don't come down, the mouse gets away and the game goes on. And so a systems thinker might initially, like an amateur systems thinker, well, a systems thinker would look at the board, the pieces, the little mouse piece, the die, right? They would look at all the little contraptions and how they all function together, and how when this thing happens, what goes next, right? Okay, that's better than full reductionist thinking of just analyzing the piece where the thing comes down to the mouse, or only analyzing the thing where the man jumps in the tub or whatever else the hell it is. I don't remember, it's been a long time. But if you were really doing holistic thinking, what happens to the game of Mousetrap if it's left in the box? Well, nothing. Nothing happens. What happens if we set the game up but nobody plays it? It just sits there. It doesn't do anything. What element in that system did we leave out in the first analysis? People. The people were left out. There is no game without people to play the game. How many people? Two players is going to have a different game than four. But what about the people that built the game? What about the design that went behind? See, if we want to look at the holistic nature of the system, you have to look at everything necessary for that game to be played. And you get a new view of markets then. So let's say that this is a little shot glass that I put cream in for my coffee. So I have to go back to the kitchen to get more cream when I pour more coffee. But let's pretend this is a bottle of Tylenol pills. and I got a headache and I need to take a Tylenol. It seems pretty reductive down to I take the Tylenol and I'm done, right? And it either works or doesn't. But how many things had to happen for that bottle of Tylenol to end up in my hand? Somebody made the label. Somebody made the box. Somebody shipped it. Somebody made the Tylenol itself. Somebody put it on the shelf. That's a holistic nature of things. And when you realize that, you realize so many things that we have, that we buy, that we take for granted is just being available. How many different people had to work cooperatively for their own independent gain so that you could buy Tylenol, or you could buy a steak, or you could buy a grill to cook your steak on, or you could buy a tub of beef tallow to cook your meat in because you don't want to use seed oils anymore. Or you could, I don't know, buy a mousetrap game and play it. Think of how many people had, and it actually should make you feel kind of grateful. It also should make you stop listening to government propaganda about how wonderful socialism is, where people are forced to do whatever the state thinks is best for them to be doing. Of course, all the young socialists think that they'll be different. Somehow they're all going to be part of the elite that write poetry and get paid to do it or something, right? It doesn't work that way. But we are able to obtain just about anything a human can dream of, assuming we have the money to purchase it, because so many people work for direct individual incentives in a cooperative way, because the system was designed so that you could go out and say, I'm only working and doing this job, making these stupid little red boxes for Tylenol until I get a better job because I need money now. But yet the chemist that comes up with the next formula for the next pain reliever that's extremely advanced and very well paid is actually doing the same thing. They're just maybe not looking to the next job anymore. They might be happy where they are. That's a holistic view. But that leads us to the next component here, which is the types of systems and how many of them are part of the total system. So we talked about how the mousetrap game and builder of castles says, when I ask that question, what happens if you just set it up and don't play it? It traps dust. Well, what keeps it from being a dust magnet is a biological component, humans that play the game. So when we look at a system, we can break that individual system down to, is it primarily a mechanical system, a biological system, a social system, an economic system? And almost every system will have a clearly identifiable, you know, primary type of system, but it will have auxiliary systems of other types attached to it. A mousetrap game is primarily a mechanical system. If you analyze it, you're analyzing the mechanical nature of the system. But without a biological system to create it and a biological system to use it, it's a dust magnet. So one of the things we want to know is, what are we looking at? Is this mechanical? Is this biological? Right? And you say, what is this thing biological and ecological? Well, it depends. You knew I was going to say that at least once today, didn't you? An ecological system would be a broader view, where a biological system might be everything that makes up an individual organism or just smaller group of organisms. What are the ecological components? Some of the ecological components of a system may not be biological. A desert system is constrained through the ecological restraint of rainfall per annum being under 10 inches. That's the literal definition of a desert. If an area gets less than 10 inches of rainfall, it's classified as a desert. That's an ecological classification. But what is a desert without the life in it? Dust. All deserts have life. Even the most drastically harsh deserts in the world have animals and creatures and plants that live in them. In fact, many of them had far more before we screwed them up and made them worse, because we like to do that as humans, because we don't look at the total system. If you look at mainstream agriculture, when some of the first readily available cheap ammonium nitrate-based fertilizers came out, basically nitrogen and we get a little phosphorus and potassium mixed in with it, the way that they got farmers who had never seen this shit to start, have you ever thought about that? Like, if you've ever talked to a farmer about doing something new or different, are they the most receptive people you've ever met about it? They're not, are they? They're skeptical. because there are people who have carved out a living in one of the hardest places to do it for a very long time in many cases. And they don't need some city boy from Jersey telling them what to do with how to grow corn in Iowa. That's just how they think. And I don't blame them. So, but do you think that's new? Do you think farmers 50 years ago or 100 years ago, when somebody said, I got new shit, they were just like, oh, bring it on, Bill. No, no. Farmers have always been skeptical. So what did the first salesman for these fertilizer companies do? They went out and handed these farmers a bag of fertilizer, big old sack. They said, go out over in your field, your lawn, where you're not even growing shit right now. Spread it out and just wait. And they came back, you know, 2, 3, 4, 6, 8 weeks later, giant green patch there. And the farmer opened up the checkbook and said, that shit works. And the first year that they put it on their crops, boy, did it. It worked. But what is that? Is that holistic or reductionist thinking? It's reductionist because I did this one time and it worked this one time. It's good. But it's like a drug. Like the drug dealer gives you the drug. You take the drug. You get a nice high. You're all happy. You want more drugs. You buy more drugs. And does it again. It's not quite as good, but it's pretty good. So you do it for a while, and it starts to diminish. And the drug dealer goes, price went up, and you're going to need to buy twice as much. That's how stupid we are. We made that decision collectively as a nation to go to these chemicals through reductionist versus holistic thinking. Because we didn't think about, well, what made this field productive in the first place? Instead of troubleshooting one end of the system to the other and saying, if I add this thing, even if it works in the short term, what does it do to the overall process? Well, it damages the overall process. It shuts down the biological components of the system, and it worsens the ecological consequences where the system's brittle. You see how that works? See? That's where we need to make sure that we're looking at not just whether the system's primarily mechanical, biological, ecological, or social, but how do other pieces fit into it? If you look at the work that was done in China to restore the Lus Plateau, that is a ecological and biological system primarily. But what managed that system was people. And you think in China, they just say, everybody do what we say, or we're going to line you up against the wall and shoot you. Well, that has limits, how far a state can get doing that, because that makes people like either run away or fight back. And neither one of those is going to get you what you want. So there was a huge social component into getting these peasant farmers and peasant like goat tenders and shit to do things differently without addressing the social component to go along with the ecological limitations and the biological realities of the Lus Plateau. They could have never, ever changed it. And if you've never listened to or watched the documentary with John DeLue about the Lus Plateau, you probably should. It's incredibly inspiring. And you'll see what I'm talking about. It couldn't be handled from just a ecological and biological and mechanical standpoint. Earthworks would be mechanical. It had to have a social component to show the people that lived there how, if they did this, yes, you might give something up this season or even next season, but long term, you'll have longevity to your way of life. You will have a way of life that you know to be able to hand down to your sons and your grandchildren. And that was very important to those people. So understanding the social component became important. You're not doing systems thinking unless you're doing that kind of analysis to something, including like, well, I'll have the kid take care of this thing in the backyard. And then the kid doesn't do it for 4 days and the fish die or whatever. Well, why? Because you didn't understand that a 12-year-old has a social component to it that needs to be addressed properly to make sure that that is as reliable as an automated timer, which maybe you should have went with a mechanical solution. You see what I'm saying? That's thinking from a systems level. Feedback loops are the next point that I want to cover with you. And these are self-reinforcing and balancing cycles within a system. What keeps things from going off the rails? is your feedback loop. So a feedback loop might be something like if you had an aquaponics system, you have a monitor for nutrient level, and that is wired into a system that has some function of an alarm. And so when that nutrient load goes above a certain threshold, and not the threshold where 1 point more will kill the fish, you are alerted. Okay, that's a feedback loop. That says, warning, Will Robinson, warning, Will Robinson, do something. Now, if we got really innovative from an engineering and mechanical solution standpoint, we could automate the response to the feedback loop. We could do something, because I've been kind of mulling different uses for biochar over lately beyond what we normally think of. And so in that aquaponics system, we could have something like a 20-gallon ebb and flow bed that's off, no plants in it, just full of biochar. But there's a valve. And when that nutrient load goes above a certain level, that valve switches and turns on that ebb and flow bed. And all of a sudden, that whole system is being also cycled through that biochar, which is going to do what? Adsorb nutrient. It sticks to it like a magnet and pulls it out of the water and reduces that overall load on the system. So now we've understood the feedback loop and we've tied it into an automated response. This is mimicking nature. That sounds very engineering, very technical, very computerized, but nature has many feedbacks that regulate things. One of the reasons that all of these alarmist predictions about global warming never happen are four primary feedback loops in the system that allow Earth to maintain balance. If one thing goes up, another thing goes down and pulls one back into balance with the other. Doesn't mean we can't totally fuck it up, but it's why they're not accounting for these feedback loops, because they're into an isolationist model, because they're being told to fulfill an objective, which is come back with this result. So eliminate as much as you need to get to this result, and we'll give you more money for another grant. That's again, a reductionist model, and it's ignoring the feedback loops. There's feedback loops in everything. And sometimes there's a mixture, again, let's say mechanical, biological, right? You're a biological element in a system. Your car is a mechanical system. You're driving your car. Everything seems fine. Red light ahead. You put on the brakes. No warning lights or anything comes on, but you hear that high-pitched little squeal. What is that? Some of you don't know, and you keep driving around until you fuck up your rotors. What it is on your brakes, there's a little metal clip, and when the padding material on the brake shoe gets thin enough, that little piece of metal starts harmlessly rubbing the rotor on your vehicle. And that means that you have to accept the feedback and say, I need to put new brakes on this vehicle soon, or I'm going to wear that padding down to the metal part of the shoe and start cutting my rotors, and I'm going to go from needing about $200 to repair my vehicle and replace something designed to fail, and I'm going to end up spending $2,500 to put four new rotors on this damn thing or more now because everything's gone up in price. That's feedbacks. And you can look for feedbacks everywhere, and you can design feedbacks into systems, and well-designed systems have feedbacks that trigger balancing responses. Okay? Then you can look at something that's become very famous from a guy called, I think, Plan B in the Bitcoin space, stock-to-flow models, right? Stocks and flows. All that is, it sounds important, it sounds special, it sounds really smart if you don't know what it is, and you see a guy make a graph and it happens to track with the price over time. But all it is the resources in a system and their movement through it. That's it. And so we can look at let's go back to biochar and biologics with biochar. So we put the biochar in the feed, right? And the biochar is now in the feed. So the biochar was a resource that we purposely generated. The feed is a resource we either produced or we purchased, somebody made it for us, and we intentionally put the two together. Duck comes along, chicken comes along, goose comes along, goat comes along, eats the biochar along with the feed. The biochar then moves through the system. It moves through the biological system that is, let's say, a duck. It goes through its gut. It takes toxins out of the animal's body. It improves feed efficiency, and the bird now craps it onto the ground. The biochar now is completely full of nutrient. It becomes part of the soil cycle. What we're doing is we're simply tracking the movement of that item, that resource through the system and where it ends up and how entropy affects it. Some resources have very rapid entropy through a system, meaning they actually are used up, truly non-renewable. They are gone. Some are midterm and some are very long-term. In the case of that biochar, that resource, unless it's somehow washed off the property that we're including in this analysis through erosion, it will be there when your great, 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 great grandchildren are dead. It will still be there. It is a long-term resource in the system. So we can start to classify, is this a short-term, mid-term, or long-term resource as it moves through the system? Does it create a feedback loop in that when it's gone, it's now deficient, or does it actually build up a reserve that creates a feedback loop that makes inputs no longer necessary? And that could be a permaculture farm type system. It could be, if you design things with the right social mechanisms, a company that literally runs itself. I don't ever have to go out and find new talent to bring into the company because I build a culture in the company where every employee is a recruiter for the company and we promote from within. So the only thing we ever need to fill are like the first two levels in the company. All of this is examples of stock to flow analysis. When they do it with Bitcoin, all they're saying is here's how much, because we actually know the finite amount in the issuance schedule, and we can project probable demand based on past performance, we can say based on the flow rate of resource and how long it gets tied up for, what the price should be 5 years from now. And actually, if you look at that dude's graph, I kind of mock him a little bit because I think he tries to make himself look smarter than he is. He's got a very good model. It's been, well, it came out of the bands. Yeah, but it's more accurate than anything anybody else ever did because it's relying on math and tracking a resource through the system, that stock to flow relationship. Then you have what are known as emergent properties. Emergent properties are one of the trickier things because you don't necessarily know that they exist until they show up. In fact, they may not have existed until they showed up. Emergent property sounds really important, special words, but all it is new behaviors that arrive from interactions of the parts. Maybe it was self-evident it was going to happen. Maybe it wasn't, but two things come together, and if they come together rubbing against each other, we get a phenomenon known as friction and an emergent property known as heat. Maybe we want heat. Maybe heat's good. Maybe we don't want heat. Maybe it's bad. Maybe if we're getting heat from friction, we're probably damaging components and we need to at least minimize it or plan for replacement of the components like brake pad. Now, I don't think that the heat, friction, and wear of a brake pad on a rotor was truly much of an emergent property in that it was probably planned for the first time somebody made a brake and understood that this would be the result. But had they not, that friction and heat and wear on the part would be an emergent property. Well, we better figure out a better material to make a brake pad out of than whatever we started with. Rubber isn't going to last as long as the composites we use today, for instance. So emergent properties would also be like in a agricultural system, Mark Shepard's operation. When he started putting in all of the earthworks and key line design into his system and putting in these pocket ponds, he put the pocket ponds in because when there was too much water, rather than have the water run off the property, it was better to collect in these little ponds, create these little ecosystems, slowly have that water actually enter the landscape instead of run across it. And by designing them in the right way, shallow enough, wide enough, broad enough, he could correct for certain parts of the design I can't get into today, basically to allow large mechanized equipment to have consistent distances to do things like harvest or cut hay in between lines of trees. And since it was all designed that way, certain if you were there and you had to drive equipment through during a wet period, you could drive through them and not get a vehicle stuck. That's why he also called them drive-through ponds. But there was an emergent property, a biological emergent property, amphibians. And next thing you know, he's got four species of frogs that are considered endangered living on his farm, not being killed by pesticides, because that property was absent the system, no pesticides. So that was emergent. He didn't have any idea when he designed that system that that's what was going to happen. That property emerged. In this case, it was a positive emergence. So all that's to be done then is to say, is there any way we can encourage it further? Is there any way we can create longer longevity for these little critters, someplace we can put something a little more permanent so that they have this, but yet they have a retreat mechanism? Or do we just let it be what it is, but at least we know it's there and we're aware of it? But that's an emergent property. From there, we look at causality and causal loops, cause and effect cycles within the system. This is really easy to understand from a basic programming standpoint, especially with a lot of different search tools and algorithms are being built today. If this, then that. That's kind of the easiest, most reductionist way to think of this one piece of this total system design philosophy. If this thing occurs, then that other thing will occur. Or if this thing occurs, this other thing won't occur, but it should occur. And how do I link the two together to make sure that happens? In other words, if this building catches on fire, sprinklers should go off and put out the fire. Okay. Well, how do I get that to happen? I put in sprinklers that are designed to go off, but some engineer somewhere said, you know, I don't want Jack sitting in his office and all of a sudden he's doing a podcast, and because they care that much about me, right? And all of a sudden all his equipment's damaged and feed goes out because his sprinklers went off because he got really animated and the temperature in the room went up to 80 degrees. Or his air conditioner died and temperature went up to 80 degrees. So what temperature can we determine probably means that we need to deploy a sprinkler or a Hellon unit or something like that. And they figure out how to make a metallic alloy that melts at that temperature, and they cap the emitter with it. And when that temperature rises and that melts off, the pressure's already there, and it's better to be wet than burnt. It's better that your equipment in an office like this has water damage than for the whole thing to burn to the ground and everybody to die. That's causal loops and designing that into your system. So sometimes the system is wholly biological and ecological, and we haven't touched it, and we're looking for the causal loops to understand it, or we're designing a system, whether it be mechanical or ecological or what have you, or even a village or a town in its social systems, and we're going to look for cause and effect and causal loops and how to take a resulting response to something that we know sooner or later will happen and mitigate the negative response in some way, to put something in place to cause it to not go off the hinges. As much as I complain about our government and our system of law and order, et cetera, and how it's unfair, it does serve some function. And the basic function is, if we didn't have some means, and I think there are better means than we have, we didn't have some means to deal with the fact that if I break into your house and steal your shit, some men or guns are going to come take me and put me away and give you some form of justice and possibly make me provide some form of restitution to you. If you didn't have anything in place to mitigate that, then the most likely thing would be I'd break in your house, steal your shit, and you'd come to my house and blow my fucking head off. Because you don't have we can foresee in society, if we don't do something to protect individual rights, individuals will defend their own rights, and individual organisms are highly variable. So the response will be highly variable. Some people will let others get away with it. Some people will just take the shit back. Some people will beat the shit out of somebody. Some people will kill them. And some people might kill their entire family and their children's children to punish them for a curse upon curses. Who knows? So we have to look into these systems, what's likely to occur to the negative or the positive, what's the feedback, and then how do we address that so that we can keep the system operational and doing optimum results for us, whether it's a system to grow vegetables or a system to grow a company. It's the same thing. Then we're looking for leverage points. Leverage points, another way to understand leverage points would be to think about something called the butterfly effect. The idea that this little tiny change in the time stream over here will have a magnified effect when it reaches the other end of the continent or the world or the universe or what have you, depending on where you're observing this. But where can you get a small change to create a larger impact? This is actually a permaculture design principle. Make small changes for big impacts. Where can I do one little thing, one little flick, and dynamically change the entire process? Jeff Lawton talked about a design he did one time, a permaculture design. I think this was like subtropics design. And it was a fairly steep slope, and then it kind of moderated out into a flat area, and then the property ended. And they did a whole series of swales on the steeper slope with little pocket ponds and larger ponds and water dams and what have you, all types of forestry agriculture and more conventional agriculture in this system. And they had animals in the system, so there was a nutrient cycle moving through it. And right at the bottom corner of the property, where they now, because they had all of this earthworks done and all this water being infiltrated into the landscape, basically had a weeping spring. And this water is weeping and going down the road to the neighbor's property. And they look at it and they say, you know what? There's enough space there to put a little pocket pond in there, like, you know, 20th of an acre, little pond. And so they put this little pond in there, and this pond is going to be pretty nutrient dense because it's got all of this nutrient cycling coming down with it. And so then they say, well, we want to trap the nutrients. So they plant reeds in the pond. This is not a fish pond. It doesn't matter if the reeds grow across the whole damn pond. It doesn't matter if the pond's only a couple feet deep. It's serving that purpose. It is to, and it's still got water coming out. So you've now done everything you can, and some of that water with some level of value to it, some level of nutritive value. This is not like nutrient runoff from a conventional farm is going to damage something. Wherever it goes, it's actually going to improve life. So you've done all you can, but you planted those reeds. What do those reeds do? They take a lot of that nutrient up out of that water and that muck deposit, do they not? Of course they do. So you cut the reeds, throw them on a wheelbarrow, or maybe you got a riding lawnmower, a little trailer on it, cut the reeds every once in a while, take them all the way back up to the top and mulch the top berm with them. And with a little flick, you've taken that nutrient that would have went down the road and you flicked it back up. You'll never completely win the battle with entropy there. There will always be some that will leave. But with that moderate change, now we've taken all, and since we've used a reed that is like all aquatic reeds, it's going to scavenge as much as it can. It's going to grow as fast as it can. With one little maneuver, we've recycled the nutrient flow, and we've improved the overall system. That would be one example of that. Then we want to look at system archetypes. What are the common patterns of behavior in systems? This is something we've kind of been covering all the way through. When I'll say, like, this thing over here and this thing over here, actually, we analyze them the same way. This is the permaculture principle of designing from patterns to details. This is the principle of pattern recognition, that when some news report comes out, if you've been paying attention to the show a while and you've been trained up in the way to understand it, or you've just done it on your own, as soon as you read the headline or you hear the reporter opening salvo, you go, "That's bullshit. That's bullshit." You know, it's bullshit. It follows the bullshit formula. It ain't just that it came from mainstream media, because that's part of the pattern too, right? But like when you see blah, 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 comma experts say, you should know immediately this is bullshit. Because the entire concept of that headline is fabricated into fictitious concept. Because how many experts do there have to be for me to use the word experts truthfully, with a little bit of air quotes around it? I believe that would be two. If I have two people who are experts that agree with this headline, I can make the headline and say I'm being truthful, right? Okay, now who said they were experts? Probably their CVs, probably their promotional materials. So if I find two or three people that agree with this idea, I can put this article out with experts say. And my pattern recognition should be, because that's true, odds are this is bullshit, or they would have had a more concrete and substantial way to make their point. Right? Now, that's not really systems design, but it is pattern recognition. When we look at system archetype, we're looking for pattern recognition within larger systems. So if you're a good car mechanic, odds are if you go look at a problem with a generator, you may not have seen it exactly that way before, but you kind of understand it's still a motor. You know, if it's a gas motor and it uses oil, it's, you know, it's a four-cycle motor. It's got oil and an oil filter and a place the oil is retained and a pump. And there's probably drive belts of some kind. There's probably a spark plug. If it's a push button start, there's a battery and some form of starter motor. And so when you see a problem on it, even though you've never worked on it before, there's enough in common with it that you can probably troubleshoot and figure it out if you're a good auto mechanic. Yeah, and if you're an auto mechanic and you've always worked on Fords, you may not know everything about a Chevrolet, but you probably can work on one. You see what I'm saying? Those, because there are commonalities in those systems. But there's more commonalities than that. There's more commonalities than what you would think. You know, there's a lot of commonalities between something that seems entirely made up mechanical with biological element, like an aquaponic system, compared to an aquatic natural system. But there's actually a lot of similar archetype in the patterns and structures. Now we've gone and taken this larger natural system and we've made it in an artificial containment zone. But we better pay attention to how nature does things so we can compensate for the smaller system with our desired outputs. Or we can look at a lake or a creek and we can understand how it functions, and then we can turn around and see that it's the same archetype of the system that runs something like the 55-gallon fish tank that's directly behind the camera that I have, you know, rainbow fish swimming around in. If I don't match this system to that system in some way, eventually that system's going to start to degrade and have problems. So, moving from there, we also want to look at the system from a standpoint of resilience and adaptation. And what that means is, what is the ability that it has to recover and evolve in response to change? So, you know, I have physical limitations here, but I've tried to design my property so when we have hard summers with low rainfall every year, but some years are worse than others. So if I was in a different physical constraint, if I had 20 feet of dirt before I hit rock, a lot of the things that I did, this property wouldn't even breathe hard in a summer where it barely rained for 3 months. It's an absolute disaster here now when that happens. It takes heroic efforts to keep things alive, and that sucks, but that's a function of the landscape. And there's only so much can be done within that landscape, just like you can only do so much to mimic the lake in a 55-gallon fish tank. And you have to work within those limits. But can you design greater resiliency in, or can you identify opportunities for greater resiliency? And then we ought to start thinking of how these fit together. Remember we talked about leverage points, key areas where small changes create big impacts? Can we take the leverage point and use it to increase resilience and adaptation? And the answer is usually, if we look hard enough and think hard enough, yes, we can. All right, this is where I'm going to remind you guys, if you have any questions for me, I haven't seen a single one come in yet. You need to put the word question in all caps, or comment if it's a comment you want me to comment on in all caps, and then do it. And while I'm kind of wrapping up here toward the end today, if I get any of those, I will address them at the end. And I will apologize for the fact that I did not do that yesterday. I had like 3 questions and I ended up wrapping because we went long. And as soon as I hit end stream, I'm like, shit, I was supposed to answer those. I'll try not to do that today. But I want to give you some ways to develop systems thinking in your life. Just 5 little bullet points here and some commentary on them. One is, start practicing seeing the big picture. Don't go out and say, I want to systems design something today or systems analyze something today. Just practice on focusing on everything connects. You can do this anywhere. Go into a library. They still exist. Sit down. It's nice and quiet. Nobody will make a noise and bother you. And watch how that system functions. How people come in to not just, well, they use the Dewey Decimal System or the computer now, right, or whatever. How do people enter? How do they exit? How are books checked out? How is everything arranged? Where are the computers? Because when I was a kid, there was one computer in the library. You had to sign up for 5 minutes of use. Right now, there's just computer banks. How does that whole system work? That's seeing the big picture. Like, and how much would this help people that end up taking over management positions and all that are very myopic, and they go in and they start talking shit and talking down to people and talking about working harder and making changes before they understand anything about how that existing system is working? I don't care if it's a bad system. I don't care if it's a bad system. Unless you have already run it, like if it's a division in a company and it's exactly like another, it's just in a different city, maybe you'll get by just implementing what you did, but there's a different social system there. There's different social incentives or different people. So if you were smart, you would go in and you would look at the big picture end to end. You would say nothing for 2 or 3 days until you got a handle on how that entire division was running. Then and only then would you start to interview people in the system about what they think about how it's running and how it could run better. And you would never take one person and say, this person's a genius. We should do everything they say, because you know that everything's compartmentalized. And you would get outside of those compartments before, and then you would start to implement change. And if you were really smart, you would do it in a way where the people understood that's what you had done. So they felt like you were cooperating with them, that you were advocating for them, instead of just coming in and throwing your dick around, which is how most people handle that opportunity. And that's why it generally doesn't go well for them, especially when it's like one company taking over another company or something like that. That's usually when it really goes wrong. Maybe I'll talk a little bit later about that, because I could give you two prime examples of where I saw it literally ruin everything that one company thought they were buying when they bought the other company, and losing all the talent and all of the opportunity that came with that acquisition. It basically turned it into, you got rid of a competitor, but in the end, all you did was piss your bunny away. It happens. You also want to use what I would call like a causal loop diagram. Remember we talked about understanding feedback back loops and stops and stock and flow and causal loops? You want to actually map that out. And you don't have to be like some drafting wizard or some artist and make it look all beautiful. Simple bubble diagrams and understanding what is the flow through this system right now. Where are the disruptions, the interruptions? Where are the strongest points? Where are the weakest points? And again, you don't have to this is kind of like when I tell people, when you learn enough about permaculture design to actually sit down and design a permaculture property, do not design your property first. Don't even worry about designing a property that anybody's ever going to do anything with. Walk down the street, look at your neighbor's property and design their property as though they hired you to do it. Go to a public park and say, I'm going to change this into a permaculture park with edible landscaping that I'm still going to have a place for children to play. And you'll do a much better job because you're not emotionally attached to it. Well, learning to do causal loop diagrams is kind of the same way. Think of it like mathematics. When you first start doing mathematics, you need to memorize that 9 plus 4 equals 13, or 9 times 4 is 36. 36 what? 36 what? This is why a lot of people don't like math, because when you first learn the fundamental building blocks of mathematics, the numbers don't mean anything. Jack, you figured out x equals 4. You didn't show your work. Is x 4? Yeah. Well, you're supposed to show your work. Well, I don't care about my work because I don't know what the fuck x is. X doesn't mean anything to me. Anybody in the audience in the live stream ever felt that way when you were like in high school or college and taking algebra or calc or trig or something, and it'll be like, yeah, but X and Y don't mean a fucking thing to me. I was much better at advanced chem in school than I was at algebra, even though they're mathematically like working a chemical equation. It's very similar, but the chemical bond, at least I knew what it was. But the fundamental skill sets, when you learn martial arts, you learn to do a front punch. Front punch what? The air? But you have to start somewhere. And with causal diagrams, it's kind of the same thing. It doesn't really matter what you're diagramming. You're learning the how to diagram. And if you can start doing this, then you can get into the point where you really can look at a system and begin to make notes. And somebody looking at it goes, what is this crazy maniac doing? But you know, that's all that matters. Unless you're selling the design to somebody, it doesn't matter who understands it. As long as you do it, you can then implement and build that system, or communicate with contractors who are going to build that system, or communicate with employees that are going to work within that system. You might want to get a little more refined at that point, but initially you just need to learn how to diagram the process, a flow chart, if you will, of a system. Next would be, you need to think far more about long-term consequences. In Bitcoin, we call this having a long-time preference versus a short-time preference. This is absolutely the case. This is a benefit if you don't even care about systems thinking. This is the thing you can take from today that will make your life better. Our people today in this country tend to not think about gratification past next week. And if it's next week is part of it, then you're lucky. And that's usually only because there's some totem there. 2 weeks from now, I'm going on vacation. So they're actually focused on 2 weeks from now. But if 2 weeks from now, nothing different is going to happen, they don't even care about what this action today will cause to happen 2 weeks from now, let alone 2 years or 20 years from now. If we thought about the future impacts of our actions, we would be more likely to start saving 10% of our money all the way back when we were 16, got our first job, instead of spending it all. Yeah. And that's something we fundamentally understand, but we tend not to do. Systems thinking, you have to do the same thing. Yes, if I put this fertilizer on the cornfield from our earlier discussion, the corn will grow more this year. It will make more ears, and I will get more money. And as long as the amount of money I get more than what I would have, that delta exceeds the cost of the fertilizer, it's a good investment. Great, you've made basically a six-month timeline decision on a piece of ground that you're going to manage for 25 or 30 years. Does that make sense? So you need to start looking at any system that you can analyze and say, what's going to happen to this system in 10 years, 15 years, 20 years? And sometimes it is, this system will only last 10 years and it'll need to be replaced. Sometimes that's the right choice. But you should know it when you make it. You should know it when you make it. If you don't know that when you make that choice, then you don't plan for that eventual failure. Most people don't know. You put a brand new roof on your house, asphalt shingles. What's the life expectancy of an asphalt shingle roof? Anybody know? Anybody know the two-word answer that I'm going to say before I give you the answer? Anybody know what that is? Come on, guys. You've been around me long enough to know. It depends. Where are you? What kind of shingles are they? Who put them in? Where is it done right? What's the pitch of the house? What's the solar exposure of the house? But there are still, right, there are still general averages. And in the state of Texas, assuming the roof's not ripped up by, hail, storms, and wind, it's 15 years. Our harsh sun, the angle of our roofs, the general exposure of the average building means that when you put a brand new roof on a house, you're going to get about 15 years out of it. Now, if you're buying a house that you plan to live in for 5 to 7 years and you know you're going to move, let's say you're in a job that you're going to be required to move and you need a new roof, I don't even give a shit about other options. I don't care because the roof will be in good repair when I sell the house, so it's not going to impede the sale. If anything, it's going to enhance the sale because the roof looks good. So I don't care. If I'm planning on living in this house till I die, I might really want to look at some of the new metallic. If I like the composite look, then I might want to look at some of the new metallic shingles that look exactly like composite roofs that have lifetime warranties. They cost about twice as much. Well, they cost about twice as much with today's pricing, but what's going to be the cost of a new composite roof in 15 years? Do I even have the money? Like, I have to look at long-term consequences, bet back in against, you know, how's it going to hold up in a storm versus this? What is the effect, if I'm going to be a systems thinker, what's the effect on the electric bill? Some of these new metallic roofs that look a lot like, they look exactly like composite. They also have a high reflective thermal value, and they actually will cut your cooling if you live in a hot climate like I do, the electrical uses by about 15%, which is very significant now. That's long-term consequences. Does that mean go buy a metal roof? No. It means you need to think about everything in your life from a standpoint of what does it do for me now? What does it do me for midterm? And what does it do for me long-term? And what is the end of cycle for this system? What does that look like? And what are the consequences of that end of cycle? What's going to be the cost of removing these components from my property, for instance? It's something that we all should do a little bit more of. Next, you need to challenge your mental models. And that means that you need to question very hard your assumptions and your beliefs. Because this will work, you know, that's pissing in the wind, basically. You don't know that it's going to work. You need to, like, why do I think it's going to work? Has it ever worked before? You know, if you were Kamala Harris and you were willing to challenge your mental models, assuming she has any, then when you start talking about putting pricing controls on groceries to stop price gouging, one of your first questions before you put that as a policy would be, has anybody ever done this before and did it work? Did it help? And the answer would be, it has been done before and it's never fucking worked. So right there, you would challenge your mental model and go, well, if we're going to do this and we're going to make it work and everybody else that did it, it failed, what exactly would we do differently and why would we expect a different result by making that one change? What it should make you think of, there's a cartoon and it's a dude with a giant fork and he's trying to push it into a giant electrical outlet, like the electrical outlet itself is as big as his head. And he's got a giant fork and he's trying to jam it in there and the electrical outlet says socialism. And the guy is watching him do it, is talking to him. And he says, everybody else who ever did that got hurt. And he said, yeah, well, they all did it wrong. That is a lack of being willing to challenge your mental models. Where has this thing been done before? And what were the results? And do I like those results? If you can answer all that to the affirmative, it's probably okay to do it. If you say, where has this been done before? And the answer is, it really hadn't, but I'm a genius. You better put some mitigating components into that decision. You might want to test that shit before you go broad scale with it. Yeah? Challenge that mental model. If the answer is it has been done before, and in most instances where it was done before, it failed, and the ones where it succeeded, can't really put my finger on the difference, you might be just, these are some one-off lucky examples. You aren't necessarily going to be able to do it too. Or everywhere it's ever been done, it failed, but I got a new way to do it and it'll work. That's great. That's being innovative. But if that is everybody that ever tried to make this thing fly, when they tried it, it crashed, you might want to go off like a 10-foot drop with it before you go off a 1,000-foot drop with it. Very, very simple. You need to challenge those mental models. And when I'm saying these ways to develop systems thinking, I'm saying you need to do this all the time. It's a natural thing. You know, I'm not talking about being a Debbie Downer, but look at things and go, where do I think this is going to fail? And then when you were right, that forms a positive mental feedback to, you know, when I see this again, it's probably going to fail. And when it comes out you were wrong, then it's really interesting. I'm more interested when I say, this won't work. And then it does. And then I want to go, well, what did I miss? Because odds are I was right if what I saw was everything. there was some piece I didn't see that corrected for what I was concerned about. That's really interesting. That's where you really begin to learn, because now you can dig into, well, why did I miss that? And how did the person that designed it, or how did the natural system know to do that thing? I remember when I was really young, I was a teenager, pre-Army years. Me and a buddy of mine named Heath and a bunch of our friends, we went to this drag racing event. John Force was there. That'll date it for how long ago it was, with the Hooters girls. But John Force had nothing to do with this. They had the thing like kind of at the midterm break of the races. They bring out some stunt guys. And they bring this guy out to do this stunt, and he's going to ride a motorcycle up a ramp. But the ramp goes up to a van. The van's parked there. And the ramp doesn't go over the van. He's going to intentionally drive the front tire of his motorcycle into that van. He's going to crash into it on purpose. This is going to throw him in the air. Pyrotechnics are going to go off. He's going to go through the fire, do a couple flips, and land on his back in a big pile of boxes. Cool. He must know what he's doing. If he didn't, he'd be dead by now. Well, we're sitting there watching it, and here comes the motorcycle. And the mental computer's going in my head. And my buddy Heath is not the sharpest tool in the drawer, but he has his basic spatial perception down pretty good as well. And we realize he's not speeding up. We look at each other, and I go, he's going to clear the – or he's not slowing down. And the speed he's moving, he's going to clear the boxes. And I look at Heath and I go, he's going to clear the boxes and hit the ground. And Heath goes, I think so. Boom. His left foot barely caught like the last box in the pile. And he like just got fucked up. We could instantly look and mental model him landing on the concrete. And he did. Had he not landed on the concrete, it actually would have been less fun for us, been more fun for him, but it would have been more interesting. Why didn't I, you know, if I was wrong, why was I wrong? Everything looked like he's going to land about right here, but he landed here. What did I miss? Did I misjudge the angle? You know, if that angle of that board had been higher, then he would have went higher in the air but had less distance. That would have changed the trip. There would have been some reason for it, but we were able to mentally model, me and my other buddy, we were like 16 years old, dude's about to wipe out, and he did. And so in all instances, you should be evaluating these things, you know. And then the last is engage in alliterative learning, another big word. But what that really means is improve through ongoing feedback. As you're doing all these things I just went through, constantly reinforce, I was right and I was right because. I was wrong and I was wrong because. I was right in spite of the fact that actually I know now I probably should have been wrong. Creating those feedback loops that are in the system in your mind to constantly judge yourself, accept feedback, and improve. And this is why if you're target practicing with a pistol, let's say, and you set up 5 sporting clays, and you take your pistol and you shoot, and the clay breaks, and you shoot and you miss, and then you shoot and you break a clay, and you keep doing it until all 5 clays are broken. It is a more recreational experience than setting up a piece of paper and then going looking at the print after you fire, let's say, 10 shots. You know, 5 were in and 5 were out, and they were low left, and that means I'm pulling and whatever. And that's good training and good practice, but when you fire and the clay cracks or the can falls over or the bottle shatters and you get feedback from your action, and that feedback is instantly positive or instantly negative, it has a greater ability to reinforce that what I did was right or wrong in my form, my stance, my trigger squeeze. And then we can start to ask ourselves if we're being more sophisticated about, yes, I didn't break it that time. I didn't shatter the bottle. I didn't knock over the can. What did I do? What did I do? And by consistently practicing, you become a better shot. I'm just suggesting that you do that with how you analyze things in your life. You do the same thing. You look at and design systems. You look at and assess systems. You make judgments on those assessments, or you make judgments on the installation, and you do them and you accept the feedback. And when you get the feedback to the negative or to the positive, you apply it to the future. Again, this is one of these shows that I get to the end of doing, and you know what I think? Why don't we teach this in like junior high and high school? I think like this is naturally intuitive for me to do these things, but I didn't even understand them until I was in my 30s. How much more would I have accomplished in my life if when I was in 10th or 11th grade, one of my teachers had done, you know, two or three classes on this subject that we had today? Why is it a redneck duck farmer has to tell America these things? How much of this actually is there out there other than like, you know where you'll find it? Specialized courses and certifications for things like programmers and engineers. Anybody that's in this audience today that was like a professional engineer that designs systems for a living is going, yep, mm-hmm, yep, tell me something I don't know, boy, yep, yep, uh-huh, yep, mm-hmm, yep. In fact, that one ain't quite right, but I'll let it go. Like, that's how any engineer or like a sophisticated programmer, not just some guy that hacks together some PHP strings, learned out of a book and slaps up a plugin for WordPress, but somebody who actually does serious software development and programming, they're going, yep, mm-hmm, yeah, uh-huh, yep, yep, sure. Yep, that's right. Of course. Most other people, you'd think this guy's freaking college professor or something. No, this is not actually anything beyond any average person of regular level of intelligence ability to understand. There might be some descriptive words or some multisyllabic words that we use today, but it is still on the reality. It's common sense. It's common sense. And if you really want to see it, look at indigenous societies. They do this intrinsically. And they do it because if you're living truly from the land and the resources around you, and you don't, you might not call it stock and flow, but if you don't understand resource moving through system and where the weak points are and where the negative feedbacks are and where if we hunt too much of this species, it goes away, you fucking die. So common sense kicks in, and you know, the elders say, hey, we've killed enough zebu or whatever this year. No more. I'm going to go live on guinea fowl for a while now and some fishing. And we're going to plant some of this stuff over here because we planted it over there so long and we're going to get diminishing returns. We're going to do a rotation. That's systems thinking. And every indigenous culture that survived was a master of it. The indigenous cultures in the Amazon before they got wiped out by our illnesses from Europe that built things like the soil we call terra preta, and built one of the most ecologically sustainable agricultural and animal-based systems the world has ever known that lasted thousands of years in a place where we said it couldn't have been there because no one could do it, were systems thinkers. But it all started little pieces, parts that slowly got cobbled together across time because people were sufficiently motivated, because if you got it wrong, you died. We live in a very comfortable world today where we can turn our back on all this and ignore it. But sooner or later, all the brittleness in those systems wears out. Okay, we got three questions. We got three questions, and I'm going to do my best with them. Yates, who is a guy who just keeps changing his screen name because he's got the same damn picture over and over again. How to build a house system. What the hell are you asking me? I'm sorry, I don't mean to be cruel. A house system? Do you mean a system by which you run your household? Do you mean an automated smart home? Do you mean a home that is a passive thermal regulating home? You do the stuff we talked about today. If you want to clarify that question in some way and I'm missing it, go ahead. I don't mean to be mean or nothing, but that's, I don't know. That's not a clear question. Builder of Castle said, how would you explain to a high IQ systems thinker who was just getting out of school, I was broken by the system instead of being allowed to make the system better? That's how the system works. The purpose of the system is what it does. You're not supposed to make the system better when you're a student in school. It's not your job. Your job is to comply with the system, to get the certification or check mark you need, and then go out in the world and then you can develop your own systems. You can either earn your way to seniority within someone else's organization or system, or you can build your own. Because the system that is the education system is not designed for students to contribute to the system's efficacy. It's never going to be. And as much as I hate that system, it could be better, but that's probably not how it should be designed. Though that's actually an interesting idea. What if we were to develop an educational paradigm where the students themselves shape the educational system over time? It would require a certain level of maturity that most people at that age do not have, or some form of negative feedback that prevented it from being abused. In other words, if their idea was we should all get free pizza, sit around and eat it and play video games all day, that should have an automatic buzzer that prevents it from happening. But if it were somehow actually angled toward improving the system so that people that came out the other end of the system were happier, healthier, more intelligent, and more capable of doing things in the real world, that would actually be really interesting. But the reality, again, is you're not broken by the system. You let the system break you because you saw the system as an enemy rather than an obstacle. And so what I would explain to a high IQ young person going through, you know, let's say junior high and high school, is you have two ways you can approach this. If your goal long term is to be something like a doctor or a lawyer or something where grades are going to matter, then you hold your nose and you shut up and you comply and you use that high IQ and do everything they tell you to without thinking too much to get A's. If you are a person that knows that what I really want to do is go off and build my own thing, and I know what I already want to do, I want to go out and build castles, then you do just enough to get through it, and you take the pieces that you enjoy, and those will magically be the classes you get A's in, and you get C's in pretty much everything else, and you're at peace with it. You really don't have a third option that I can think of. For what it's worth, I took the second one. You know, I was a guy with A's in all the classes I liked and C's to maybe low B's in the classes that I just like, Oh, I got to do it. My senior year of high school, I think I only had the first half of the year, three classes that were required. And one of them was a half year class. And then the other two I had to do for the rest of the year. And that was it. And everything else I did was either work study, study hall, senior lounge, or electives. And I took all kinds of half-year scientific electives like freshwater ecology and shit because I didn't give a fuck what my grade was going to be. And son of a bitch, it was an A because I thought freshwater ecology was interesting. And I thought as a science it was interesting. But the first day of the class when Mr. Bowser, right, I was my teacher. See, I remember this teacher from that long ago because it was a cool class. Came in and started talking about what it was about, but then he said the magic words, and if you learn this stuff, you can catch more fish. I went, holy shit, really? I'm looking around, am I getting punked or some shit? Even though punked wasn't a thing as a show back then. Like, was it a candid camera? Like, what's his name, Alan somebody back there? This can't be real. They're not really going to teach me how to catch fucking fish, are they? And this guy starts naming places like Tuscarora and Locust Lake and stuff. I'm like, I finished there. This is real. This is awesome. Right? So that's the approach that you have to take in that situation. But you are past that. If you're broken by that system, you're choosing to let what happened in your past affect your present without reining it back in. That system doesn't apply to you anymore. Everything you do in life now is up to you. And I know sometimes when you have like past traumas or whatever, it's hard to listen to somebody say, put it behind you. But on some level, most of it has to go behind you where it belongs. And Gilmer gave me $10 super chat and says, I don't even know what that means, but I love it. I don't know if you meant the whole show or just one thing in particular, but thank you, sir. I appreciate $10 super chat. Apparently, Yates was on the wrong channel anyway, so I really don't know. But I, you know what? I think it worked out. I think it worked out because I think that answer probably helped some people. So thanks for asking the question, even if you put it in the wrong box. We've all been guilty of that. I'll tell you a story. I got a guy coming on tomorrow. This guy's a retired colonel, and we're going to talk about probability of collapse according to the United States government. And that speaks for itself. But he emailed me while I was on vacation, or not really vacation. I was up doing Self-Reliance Festival. That's not really a vacation. It's work, but I'm out of pocket. And so I forwarded what I do when I'm on vacation. Everything goes in my Proton mail, and it goes, and anything that I need to do something with when I get home goes in the folder called follow up, and I forward it back to myself, and then I handle it. And usually that works fine. But I was not firing all the cylinders that morning, and I answered his email properly, then thought I answered somebody else's email and corrected it and answered the other person's email. But I answered the original dude, the colonel's email, and I like really wanted the guy on, and I emailed him back and said, look, I crossed some streams. Please don't think I'm a flake. I'd love to have you on the air. And fortunately, he filled out the guest form later that day. But we've all done it. Every one of us has put a response in a text message to the wrong person. So don't worry about it, man. It ain't no big deal at all. Anyway, with that, I'm ready to wrap things up. And I want to remind you guys again, you can always help us out by doing your online shopping, starting where? tspaz.com. We won't go deep into it because I already mentioned it, but the Anchor items are on sale big time today. Almost everything Anchor makes is on sale. Really cool electronic equipment there. My favorite value electronics brand. Everything they make's as good as like a Beats or an Apple or something like that for about 2/3 of the price. So they're not stupid cheap, but they are a great value and they stand behind everything. And I want to kind of point something out with Anchor real quick. When I started talking about Anchor, it was about 6-7 years ago. And I just through research and analyzing products and reviews found like, hell, everything these people make, they have really high level reviews that are real reviews with using analyst tools to determine whether they were fake or not. I was able to figure out this is legitimate. I started buying their stuff, but no one really knew who they were. They were pretty much a brand sold exclusively on Amazon. 2 weeks ago, we were at Costco, and there were Anchor products all over freaking Costco. This company has grown into a recognized mainstream brand, starting off as a value brand because they have such a high quality of product and because of what I said earlier. If they do have a problem, they are going to fix it. Next up, let me remind you guys about home food systems and the courses we have available. We have the Simplified Bioreactor Composting course, the Principle-Based Permaculture Design course, and the Backyard Soil and Cover Crops course, and I'm now building out the Biochar course as we speak. I'm already working on it. The Principle-Based Permaculture Design course is absolutely free, so you can get a feel for what my courses are like. If you enjoyed today's show, if you like my style of teaching, I think you'll probably learn a lot from the more structured courses that I've put together along with the exams, and you get a certificate certifying completion of the course assigned by me at the end of that course as well. Anyway, with that wrapped up, guys, I'll catch you tomorrow. Again, tomorrow, I bet you we have 3, 4, 5 times the number of people in the live stream than we had at peak today. And the reason is because when I bring the doom and the gloom, everybody shows up. Everybody shows up. And tomorrow we are going to be talking about what is the actual probability of collapse in this country? What are all of the ways that it could happen? And what are the individual chances on any given year? And what's interesting is like even the one that's the highest probability of causing a collapse, it's only like 2%. But the overall number, when they're all aggregated together and any one of them could happen, is much, much higher. And the number one item that could lead to collapse in this country, according to your own government right now, is some form of civil strife or civil war. And so it's going to be a very interesting discussion in a person who has professionally analyzed this as a military governmental person for a very long time. And I think that'll be interesting. And I know some of you are like, that's the enemy. Well, no, he's retired. He's on the outside. He wants to talk to people like us. That tells you something. And this guy wasn't a bureaucrat. He was a soldier. So anyway, take care. We'll catch you with that one tomorrow. Take care, and I will, again, I'll be back tomorrow with another episode. They said you should have a house.
the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a bed.